Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com. And your support makes this possible.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Ronald Reagan said once, "I wondered at times what the Ten Commandments would have looked like if Moses had run them through the U.S. Congress." Thankfully, that didn't happen, and we have with us the commandments that have established and impacted pretty much all of culture. In fact, that is the point of our conversation today. From a new book from John Dixon called A Doubter's Guide to the Ten Commandments, How, for Better or Worse, Our Ideas About the Good Life Come from Moses and Jesus. And Ted, I guess, I mean, there's really, you know, when we think of Ten Commandments, we maybe think about, you know, monuments or plaques on walls, mm-hmm. but they really have influenced art and science and government, just about everything else.
Yeah, it's the foundation on which we stand to live our lives, yeah. Love God, love each other.
We're going to review the Ten Commandments coming up on today's program, and the book from John Dixon, A Doubter's Guide to the Ten Commandments, it has nothing to do with the Democratic Convention,
although there, yeah, right.
maybe a few doubters there too, at least in the Bernie Sanders camp. We'll see how that goes. And just like last week, before the convention began, Franklin Graham is doing a prayer event as well, just and a good reminder for all of us to be praying for our nation, for these times of still division and uncertainty, and yet we still have the privilege of voting.
I love that he does that. It really is needed. Yeah. So much going on.
Coming up the middle of the week, we'll have an opportunity to talk with Leith Anderson about a voter's guide and how we might actually put our faith into practice and vote. So we're looking forward to that conversation. But, you know, we look at the world today without the Ten Commandments, you can say, you know, they're a lot of decisions get made poorly and a lot of hypocrisy, and that's what John Stonestreet is talking to us about now.
No way, NBA. For the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, I'm John Stonestreet with The Point. If I could add a chapter to John F. Kennedy's Profiles in Courage, I'd add one about North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory and Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest. In the face of fierce protests by corporations and celebrities, they have staunchly defended North Carolina's law that prohibits public institutions from granting men access to women's bathrooms and locker rooms. And so now the National Basketball Association has pulled next year's All-Star Game from Charlotte, a move that will cost the city and the state millions. The hypocrisy is laughable. So the NBA insists women must have their own basketball league, but not their own bathrooms? And will men claiming to be women now soon hit the hardwood for the WNBA? McCrory and Forrest will have none of this corporate tyranny. As Forrest said in his statement on the decision, "We'll never value a dollar over a woman's or a child's safety and security." God grant us more elected officials that displayed such courage. With today's Point, I'm John Stonestreet.
Now, the Ten Commandments are perhaps some of the most well-known and provoking verses of the whole Bible. When they found their way into the world's art, monuments, literature, culture, and even into Richard Dawkins' famous Ten Atheist Commandments. Well, we're going to talk today about the Ten Commandments and reference a wonderful new work from John Dixon called A Doubter's Guide to the Ten Commandments, How, for Better or Worse, Our Ideas About the Good Life Come from Moses and Jesus. Now, we've had an opportunity to talk with John in the past, and so looking forward to bringing him back on the show today. John Dixon is the co-director of the Center for Public Christianity. It's an independent research and media organization promoting the public understanding of the Christian faith. He's got a degree in theology and a doctorate in ancient history, and is a senior research fellow in the Department of Ancient History at Macquarie University, where he teaches courses on Christian origins and the world religions. He's also a senior minister at St. Andrew's in Roseville, an innovative Anglican community on Sydney's North Shore. And John, good morning to you. Great to have you with us here on Connecting Faith.
Lovely to talk with you as well.
You know, it seems like this is a wonderful new book. And you've written a couple of books relating to doubters. And maybe before we jump into that, is that a passion of yours just to try and answer those skeptics and doubters that have questions about the faith that we hold so dear?
From the very beginning of my Christian faith, which I came to as a 16-year-old, I've just felt a sympathy for those who don't yet believe. And so much of my speaking, my academic work, as well as, you know, just the popular writing, is trying to help the person who doesn't believe, who thinks there are maybe reasons not to believe, come to see that some of their best reasons aren't that good after all. And a book like Doubter's Guide to the Ten Commandments is trying to explain to people who have a hunch there might be something to the biblical moral frame, but aren't quite sure and maybe have been disappointed with the Christians they've met and so have given up on it. They're the kind of doubters that I want to engage, hopefully in a sympathetic way, not in a kind of preachy way.
You know, it does seem like the Ten Commandments have been increasingly targeted, at least even in the United States, Britain and Australia as well. But they're narrow, they're outdated, they're not appropriate for the common good. So what is it about these verses that seem to generate so much disdain?
Well, partly because they're so popular and they change the world. I mean, in the ancient world, there were codes of conduct that were, at the time, far more popular from far greater, more powerful nations. But isn't it extraordinary that these 10 words, these 10 little commandments, just a handful of statements, actually shaped the Western world? And, you know, as our culture begins to feel a bit like a teenager growing up and wanting to rebel against the parent, I think the 10 commandments seem a target because of their massive influence. So you've got to go to that target. The problem is, so much of what even the secular humanist holds dear comes from the Ten Commandments via the teaching of Jesus. And so there's a sense in which they're cutting off their nose despite their face, or chopping off the branch that they're sitting on.
Well, in fact, I know you address it early on in the book that atheists have been developing their own Ten Commandments or rules or guides. So what's different about what they outline?
Well, partly it's funny to read the famous atheist Ten Commandments because they have things like do to others as you would have them do to you, unaware that that's actually a quotation of Jesus, which, I giggled. The famous atheist Ten Commandments have things in it like there is no one right way to live. Like, that's actually one of the commandments. And you sort of think, well, what are the rest of the 9 commandments about, you know, telling us how to live? A number of those commandments say things like base your life on evidence, not on myths. And these seem to just be criticisms of sort of a biblical way of looking at things. In the end, they are really just a parody. They're a secular attempt to mimic or caricature the original Ten Commandments, but they really don't surpass the Ten Commandments.
Well, because they would say, well, these commandments aren't really, they're unremarkable. So how would you respond to that?
Well, we know they are remarkable, since there are some parts of the Ten Commandments that we don't find in many other cultures. For example, the second commandment is about not making idols or images of God. And we know that throughout history, the human tendency was precisely to make images of gods. But for the ancient Jewish culture, this was a way of preserving the otherness of God, of always regarding a separation between the creator and the creation. And as soon as you begin to identify the creator with a piece of the creation, then you end up diminishing the creator and end up diminishing yourself and other creatures as well. But if you're able to keep a complete separation between the creator, who is the source of all things, and the creation, which is dependent on God, then actually you find a way of caring for other creatures because they are loved by the creator of the universe.
You know, one of the things that I guess before we kind of dive in, we mentioned a little bit about the second commandment, and we'll get through all of them here during our time together. But, you know, the idea of being good without God, that seems to be maybe one of the points that the skeptic maybe thinks, well, we don't need God to be good.
And they're right, in a sense. Plenty of atheists, particularly in the Western world, because they've been raised in a Judeo-Christian frame, live good lives and instinctively feel, you know, I shouldn't lie, I should be kind to people. And I don't want to deny that for a moment, but it is worth pondering whether there is a rational basis for the ethic of love and compassion that even Western secularists want to adopt if there's no God. Because if there's no God, what is the basis for regarding human beings as inestimably precious, as possessing inalienable rights, as the American tradition puts it? These ideas really can't be based rationally on an evolutionary model. If we are just an accident in the universe, how on earth can you say that a human being has inalienable rights, is inestimably precious? But if there is a God whose own character is imprinted on the universe, then instantly there is a difference between the good life and the bad life. And it's a rational difference. When our lives reflect the character of the God who made everything, they are good. When they depart from that character, then they're bad. So there is a rational basis to biblical ethics that really doesn't exist in the atheist view of the world, even if we can happily concede there are some wonderfully beautiful humanitarian atheists.
And we should say a word, too, the fact that as the subtitle says, how for better or for worse our ideas about the good life come from Moses and Jesus. Of course, Moses, you know, delivered them from the hand of God. But how does Jesus understand and expand the Ten Commandments?
Well, that's a key point, isn't it? I mean, interestingly, in the Old Testament law itself, there is the acknowledgement that the people of God won't be able to keep these commandments, that they'll need to seek God's forgiveness. And so there is a sense in which even the Old Testament looks forward to a New Testament, to a new covenant, where there will be a new Moses who will provide the answer for our forgiveness because we've actually fallen short of these commandments. And the New Testament says that's Jesus. Jesus is the new Moses who died on a cross so we could be forgiven, but who also gave a law in the Sermon on the Mount that is the fulfillment of the Ten Commandments. And the historical point I want to make throughout the book is that it isn't just that the Ten Commandments shaped the West. It's the Ten Commandments via the teaching of Jesus that shaped the West. After all, it wasn't Jewish missionaries who took the law of Moses, you know, throughout Europe and around the world. It was Christian missionaries with the Sermon on the Mount, the whole gospel, and the Ten Commandments, and that's what shaped the world. And each of the commandments has a reflection in the teaching of Jesus that intensifies, or I would say beautifies, the teaching of Moses. So it's really Moses and Jesus together.
We're going to unpack the Ten Commandments. We think we know them. We'll understand more about these ancient instructions that have helped shape the world as we continue our conversation with John Dixon. John's co-director of the Center for Public Christianity, and he is also a senior research fellow of the Department of Ancient History at Macquarie University and teaches courses on Christian origins and world religions. He also is a senior minister at St. Andrew's Roseville, an Anglican community on Sydney's North Shore, and we're talking today about his new book, A Doubter's Guide to the Ten Commandments. There's more coming up. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and we're happy to have back with us today John Dixon. John's just released a new book. It's out from Zondervan, recommended reading, another in his books where he's focused on doubters. And this is A Doubter's Guide to the Ten Commandments, how for better or worse our ideas about the good life come from Moses and Jesus. And we've got 10 to get through. John, let's jump in with commandment number one. Who is God? What do we need to understand about commandment number one?
Well, the opening lines of the Ten Commandments say, I am the Lord your God who rescued you out of Egypt, have no other gods before me. So the great thing about this opening statement is that it says God has set his love on his people first, and as a result of that, we give him our loyalty. So it isn't that we obey God and then he'll be nice to us. He saves and then we give him our loyalty. But the first commandment is first, of course, because if there is one God behind everything, that animates all of life with a single meaning. Life isn't accidental. Life isn't capricious and dangerous. It is ordered by one hand who is the loving God of the universe. That fills all ethics with significance. So the first commandment is the first.
In your discussion about the commandments, one of the things that kind of caught my attention was that you talk about, you know, there's a real difference between you know, choosing not to harm someone rather than choosing to love someone. That, you know, we so much of maybe our world system is just based on, well, do no harm as opposed to actually loving one another.
Well, this is one of the innovations that Jesus really brought from the Ten Commandments into our Western tradition. He interpreted the Ten Commandments, which do seem like they're negatively framed, you know, do not murder, do not steal, and so on. He interpreted them as actually that the inner meaning of these commandments is positive, that we're actually meant to love our neighbor, that to refuse to steal from someone actually has the implication of actually sharing your goods with those in need. So, yes, you're right. He actually turned them into positive statements.
We touched on the second commandment, dealing with idols. That seems like kind of maybe a foreign concept today, but say more about that.
Well, it's true that in the West, idols have basically been banished in the religious sense. I mean, everywhere else in the world, idols, you know, were everywhere. But it is one of the influences of the Ten Commandments that you hardly see any religious idols in our culture anymore. However, Jesus said that there's one false god, there's one idol that many of us can fall prey to, and that is materialism. No one can serve God and money, Jesus said, or the Apostle Paul in the New Testament said, greed is idolatry. By which he meant, when you crave and love and almost worship created material, whether, you know, the house, the holiday, the wine, the car, you're bowing down to created stuff instead of the creator. So it's a little bit like bowing down to a little gold image of a god. And so greed itself becomes idolatry. And in the Christian tradition, that would be breaking the second commandment.
I know you give an illustration of a friend who was a Muslim and just kind of working through understanding the possibility that Yahweh was God. Just say a little bit more about that, how maybe the Ten Commandments can maybe arrest somebody's attention who is maybe a follower of Islam, for example.
Well, this was a quite an amazing insight that this Muslim friend gave me, because she'd really wrestled with the idea that Jesus could be God, because in Islam this is blasphemous to say such a thing. Because she thought it was making God into a human form. So she thought it was idolatry itself to say that Jesus was God. But then it dawned on her, she was reading C.S. Lewis, it dawned on her that it's possible to create mental images of God where you're suggesting what God can and can't do in the world. And it suddenly dawned on her that maybe her refusal to think God could, even if he wanted to, enter into the world in the person of Jesus was a form of idolatry, was a form of mental, creating a mental picture of God that wouldn't allow God to be God. And that realization made her feel, oh my goodness, I can't tell God what he can and can't do. And her confrontation with the Gospels themselves brought her to a sound and beautiful Christian faith.
Commandment number 3 has a warning. Say a little bit more about God's jealousy and how we need to take him seriously.
Yeah, so not using, not creating idols and dishonoring God comes with this kind of, I will punish, you know, the third and fourth generation, but I will bless you, you know, if you honor me. And so there is this strong sense of the jealousy of God in the Bible. And it mustn't be confused with the petty jealousy in the playground, you know, where my little 10-year-old daughter might complain that one of her best friends played with someone else at lunchtime. That would be trivial. But God's jealousy is the kind of jealousy that takes us seriously, that loves us profoundly, and that is betrayed when we set our loves on other things. And so there are these warnings about God's jealousy and God's punishment, but they're in the context of him loving us and taking us very seriously. And in the end, I would prefer a Lord that takes me so seriously than one who is hardly mindful of me.
Well, of course, we live in a culture today that, you know, really doesn't take much of life very seriously, and certainly maybe the Ten Commandments especially. I mean, we'll get into talking about Sabbath and things, but talk about the importance of being serious about, you know, honoring the Lord and realizing that this you know, this is the God of all creation.
Yes, well, I mean, the third commandment about misusing the name of the Lord has this sense in it that you're lifting up God's name lightly or to worthless things. And this has been interpreted in a number of ways by scholars. Some think it's mainly to do with making your oaths with all due seriousness. Other scholars like Christopher Wright have pointed out that it really is a critique of shallow religion, that when people take up the name of the Lord on their lips for money-making or for popularity or for trivial purposes, then they are actually misusing the name of the Lord. Because if there's a God who is the source of all things, then life is serious. Not in the kind of unhappy sense. In fact, it's the happiness of taking life seriously that I think gives life meaning. If we're just accidents, if we're all just passing through and there'll be no memory of us, no significance after our death, then life suddenly is trivial. But if we are intended and loved and inestimably valuable, then we can take each other seriously and seriously play with each other, because life isn't trivial, it's meaningful.
Well, speaking of play, let's talk about commandment number four. And as you say, we can thank Moses and Jesus for the weekend.
We sure can. It is one of those historical oddities. I mean, the ancient historian always tries to find a precedent to a particular law or cultural artifact. But no one can find the precedent for the biblical command to have one day off in seven. There's been a lot of research into this. You know, did it come from the Babylonians? Did it come from the Egyptians? Now, of course, you know, believers just say, well, it came from the Lord, so you don't need to find a precedent. But it is a striking thing that this law of one day off in seven really shaped the ancient world and now the modern world. And in fact, we can find it in the 4th century. There was a decree of one of the Roman emperors who mandated giving a day off based on the commandment of Moses and the teaching of Jesus, commanded that a day off should be had by all those who want a day off. It wasn't an imposition in the sense that if you were a farmer, you had to, you know, put down your harvesting tools during harvest time. It wasn't that. It was that no one should force people to work 7 days a week. And this applied even to the lowliest worker. They weren't to be forced by their master to work. And that became our weekend. And so if you enjoy your weekend, there's at least one thing you can say, thank you, Moses, thank you, Jesus, for.
We're going to talk more about the commandments, talk about Sabbath and more as we continue our conversation with John Dixon. John is an honorary fellow of the Department of Ancient History at Macquarie University, founding director of the Center for Public Christianity and senior minister of St. Andrews, Roseville in Sydney, Australia, joining us today. We're talking about the book, A Doubter's Guide to the Ten Commandments, and there's more to come here on Connecting Faith. Thanks for tuning in to Connecting Faith today. We're talking about the Ten Commandments, these important and perhaps provocative verses that have really impacted our entire world. And that's where John Dixon has often focused in his writing, looking at the historical precedents of biblical history. Today we're talking about A Doubter's Guide to the Ten Commandments, How for Better or Worse Our Ideas About the Good Life Come from Moses and Jesus. It's a response to, you know, the critics, the skeptics who wonder, is there relevance and meaning in the Bible today and its historical significance. We're talking a little bit about the fourth commandment, about Sabbath. It seems like there's always questions about the Sabbath. We were mentioning one of the commandments earlier about taking God seriously. Do we need to take Sabbath seriously? And are there some maybe warnings or advice that we could pull out from today's lesson?
Well, it's interesting that Jesus tended to have a more relaxed view of the Sabbath, in that he said that the Sabbath was made for mankind, not mankind for the Sabbath. That is, it's a gift to us. That's the principal way to think of it, rather than a load we are to carry. And of course, Paul in the letter to the Colossians says that the Sabbath day is a shadow of the things to come. So in the Christian tradition, there is a debate about the degree to which you must take a day off. But my point in the book is more that we should think of Sabbath as a gift of God, that we are creatures that need to work in order to feel fulfilled, but also we need to relax and to play. And if we don't relax and play, then we may well miss out on some of the blessings of this creation, since God ordered things so that we might be productive and then rest, productive and then rest. And I think if people give up the rest, they will miss some of the greatest blessings of life.
When we get to commandment number 5, we've kind of moved toward more, I guess, human relationship issues. And, you know, this one talks about obedience and honor, not necessarily easy words today, it seems, in today's culture. Say more about the 5th commandment.
Isn't it interesting that the first of the commandments about how you treat human beings is about parents? And the logic seems to be that parents are the vital connection to the next generation of all that is good. Parents are the transmitters of the good to their children. And so it makes sense that the first commandment that deals with how you treat others says you honor your parents, because they're the ones you're going to receive the good from. The word that's used there to honor is a word that really means to consider weighty. It's to do with honoring, to glorify, to regard as godlike. And that wouldn't be to exaggerate, because the word to honor is actually the same word that's used throughout Scripture for honoring or glorifying God. But it's clear in the Ten Commandments that the nuclear family, as we often term it today, was the shape of the family in Moses' time, because the Ten Commandments make clear there's one husband, one wife, and kids. And so it's a myth to say, as some people do say, that, oh, we invented the nuclear family only, you know, post the Industrial Revolution. Before then, there was no such thing as the nuclear family. Well, the Ten Commandments are over 3,000-year-old proof that nuclear family goes right back, and children honoring their parents and being in good relationship with their parents is a key to human flourishing. And when that is turned upside down, lots of things are turned upside down in our culture. The other thing I try and point out about this commandment is that when children grow up and they no longer obey their parents, the command to still honor parents was interpreted, certainly in early Christianity, as a command to honor the elderly, your older parents who now depend on you. And so the social systems and aged care that the church developed were a reflection on this very commandment. And the Western tradition of caring for the elderly, of setting up aged persons' homes, comes directly from this, since we know ancient Greece and Rome didn't have any aged care in the sense that we know it.
Once again, we've sort of forgotten our history and the impact of biblical Christianity and in the Scriptures in general on the shaping cultures so thoroughly. We're talking A Doubter's Guide to the Ten Commandments from John Dixon. John, the commandments 6 through 9, you know, do they really need to be said? I mean, how does an atheist maybe look at these commandments?
Yes, well, in a sense, you know, you should not murder, you should not commit adultery, you should not steal. These are very obvious, and I don't want to say that they are unique, because you find them in many other ethical codes through history. So it's not a zero-sum game. We don't need to say the Ten Commandments are totally unique, but there are certain ways that the teaching of Jesus transposed the Ten Commandments that are curious and did give us particular inflections in our ethical outlook. For example, you shall not murder seems plain enough, but Jesus and the apostles interpreted hating people as murder. I mean, Jesus said this explicitly in the Sermon on the Mount. The Apostle John, in his first letter, said that whoever hates the poor is a murderer. And so he actually thinks the correct interpretation of you shall not murder is you shouldn't hate anyone, and especially the poor. And so what seems like a negative commandment actually becomes an incredibly positive call to love the needy.
The seventh commandment is one that seems like we've known early on. In fact, you know, sadly, many Christian churches, those are the ones that sort of got called out if they were, if we were, you know, pointing someone out in terms of their shortcomings. Just say more about God's design for Commandment 7.
Well, Commandment 7 is really trying to preserve that relationship that is mentioned in the Commandment 5, the husband-wife, so the mother-father. It's right that children honor their parents, but those parents themselves need to honor one another. And so thou shalt not commit adultery is really a call to honor one another sexually and emotionally. And, of course, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus said even to look toward someone in order to lust for them is to commit adultery. So, again, Jesus took, you know, transposed this commandment to say it isn't just a commandment about not hopping into the bed of someone else. It's a commandment about an entire approach that so honors your spouse that you won't even look for lust and love elsewhere than the one God has given you. So it is a call to deep faithfulness.
And thou shalt not steal, Commandment 8. I mean, we sort of touched a little bit on the premise, but it has had an impact on society through the ages, hasn't it?
It really has. In fact, this was very often interpreted as a need to care for the poor, because in biblical logic, actually going right back to the book of Deuteronomy, the wealthy farmers weren't meant to harvest the edge of their property because the edge of the property, the edge of the harvest, was for the poor. And the text actually says, this is for the poor. That, in other words, the Lord has given you that for the poor. And so to actually take that is to steal from the poor. Now, that tradition goes right through into the New Testament and then into early Western history, where it was thought that to not care for the poor with my resources was actually to steal from them, since the logic is the Lord has given me abundance precisely so that some of my abundance would be for the poor. And if I keep that abundance for myself, I've stolen. This was such a thing that in the 12th and 13th centuries in Europe, there was a live debate about whether someone who stole in order to feed their family because the rich hadn't looked after them, whether that was even to be regarded as stealing. And the consensus was that such a person, if it could be demonstrated that they only stole for food to keep the family alive, then actually the rich were more guilty than the poor. Now, I'm not sure I'd want that one on the books today because it would be too, you know, open to abuse. But isn't it interesting that our tradition of caring for the poor, the sense that philanthropy is an obligation, that really does come out of this this little commandment, you shall not steal.
You know, there's a lot of concern for justice today that runs high. So how do we understand the biblical framework for justice as we look at, commandment number 9?
Yeah, so bearing false testimony is, in the context of the Ten Commandments, to do with courts of law. And we all know that truth-telling is the very foundation of courts of law, since most legal decisions that don't involve, you know, forensic DNA and so on, really are based on testimony. So the testimony people give in court really is the foundation. And so if we allow liars in court, justice can be perverted. Now, the interesting thing about the way the New Testament takes this particular command is it says that all of life is like a court of law. So the do not give false testimony of the Old Testament becomes don't lie, just let your yes be yes and your no, no in the New Testament. So that it isn't just for courts of law, it's all of life is so precious, the danger of injustice ever present, so that all speech must be truthful speech. And when you think about it, so many of the lies we might tell really derive from an unjust perspective, because lies tend to be things like protecting my honor or trying to get from someone what really belongs to them but that I want for myself. So behind every lie is a sense of injustice, a sense of I want something that I ought not have, but I want it anyway.
Which ties in very closely with the 10th commandment. Say a word about that.
That pegs us all, I think. You shall not covet. The interesting thing about this commandment is you might have thought you were doing really well through the commandments. You know, I can get away through life, you know, without murdering someone or committing adultery. But when you get to covet, it suddenly internalizes the commands and says that even your inner longings ought to come under the microscope. And so the 10th commandment is the commandment where we find out that we all, in the end, break the commandments of God. And this shouldn't lead us to despair, since the opening word of the Ten Commandments is, I am the Lord your God who rescued you out of Egypt. So God still loves us, but he knows we can't fully keep this commandment, this internal commandment about coveting, which is to desire for myself something that properly belongs to others. And in Romans 7 in the New Testament, Paul reflects on this very commandment and says it's the one that proves him to be a sinner and means that he needs to depend on the mercy of Jesus Christ and he needs the salvation of God. His morality can't save him. This commandment exposes that for him. And I think that's a great reminder to us all that the Ten Commandments are not designed to turn us into moralistic human beings. They are a wonderful vision of the good life, but it's a vision that says none of us ultimately is good. There are no good people. The myth that we're good through and through and only getting better is a secular myth. The Christian narrative says we're not good through and through. We are fallen creatures. And we certainly can't keep this 10th commandment, but thank God there is mercy available that forgives us. And then, you know, by God's Spirit, props us up and helps us to approximate the life of the Ten Commandments in the power of God's Spirit, motivated by God's mercy.
But somehow we don't really enjoy being told what not to do because we think that's not going to give us freedom. You address that. Talk a bit more about that.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? People sometimes look at the Ten Commandments and say, thou shalt not, thou shalt not, thou shalt not. I think the word not appears 13 times in these 10 sentences. And so it seems negative. But I try and point out that it's only negative in grammar. It's thou shalt not is negative grammar, but it's actually very, very positive. Because if you could choose between a rule book that tells you the 5 billion things you're allowed to do, listed in order, or the 10 things you really should avoid, everyone's going to go for the 10 things you ought to avoid because it's a simpler, more freeing way to live life. And I use the analogy in the book that I love skiing. In fact, it's ski season here in Australia right now. And when I'm at the top of a mountain, I don't want someone to tell me the 35 ways I'm allowed to go down the hill. I just want someone to tell me what are the 3 or 4 dangerous points on the hill I shouldn't ski over because I might hit a rock. The negative form of the commandment is a little more like that. Most of life is permissible. Most of life is for the free living, to God's with God's blessing. But there are these few things that thou shalt not. And if you avoid them, life is free. The rest of the mountain is yours to ski on.
John, as you've written this, I know you maybe had the skeptic in mind, the doubter in mind. What do you hope this book does, and how would you encourage people, maybe someone who is a skeptic, to approach this?
Well, I think I'd ask them to ponder what is the rational basis of their moral outlook, because it's entirely possible that they may work out that without God behind the universe, it's not possible to have a rational basis for ethics. I'd love them to consider maybe that some of their best ideas in secular humanism really have come from the Bible. So when they come back to the Bible, it's a little bit like returning home, returning to your family. And I think the embrace of this family, of this family of ethics, this family of God's grace, animates life and liberates life. And ultimately, the good life is not about being a moral person. It's about knowing the mercy of God that these commandments assume and point forward to. And then once you know that mercy, you're liberated to live in God's world, God's way, which has to be the most freeing way to live.
Well, John, as you continue to teach and to speak and to present, blessings to you as you interact so well in these important areas. We're talking to John Dixon today. John is he's an honorary fellow of the Department of Ancient History at Macquarie University in Australia, founding director of the Center for Public Christianity. He's a senior minister of St. Andrews in Roseville in Sydney, and has authored a wonderful new book called A Doubter's Guide to the Ten Commandments, How for Better or for Worse Our Ideas About the Good Life Come from Moses and Jesus. John, it's been an honor to talk with you again. Blessings to you.
Thank you, and to you.
Well, coming up in a moment, we're going to do a little reflection on about paying attention not just to the Ten Commandments, but to all the commandments, and we'll get to that in a bit. But first, a song that reminds us Jesus summed up the ten with these two, and primarily this one.
Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. With all your heart.
Well, we're talking about the Doubter's Guide to the Ten Commandments and reviewing the impact of these personal rules for living, for life, and how, for better or for worse, our ideas about the good life come from Moses and Jesus. John Dixon, our guest these past few minutes. And we always like to end the program here on Connecting Faith. We'll look at the topic maybe from a little different lens. And today, I want to share another acrostic from Dr. Mark Yarborough. Mark is the Vice President for Academic Affairs and Academic Dean, Assistant Professor of Biblical Exposition at Dallas Theological Seminary. And he, in a recent conversation, shared some practical, helpful ways for us to unlock the truth of God's Word. Because it's not just about knowing the commandments, not just about knowledge, it's about application, which is at the heart of Faith Radio day by day. Let's hear this from Mark Yarborough.
I'm going to quote one of my mentors in the faith, Howard Hendricks. You know, he used to pound this particular phrase all the time. The Bible was not written to satisfy your curiosity. It was written to change your life. And I can hear him saying that. It echoes through the halls here at DTS. And that is so true. There's nothing wrong with knowing facts and figures and being up to speed, and we've done word studies and all of that's good. We know about culture and background and the genres and all that kind of stuff, and that's wonderful. But I tell you what, if we are not in this to have our lives changed so that we can better reflect Christ in us to this dark and dying world, then we have totally missed the boat. If it is simply so that we know more than someone else and we can, you know, win our Bible Thump Award to be able to have more information, then we have totally missed out. So this last step of living it is so critical in that regard.
You use the acronym GOAL, or the word GOAL, G-O-A-L, as kind of a little a way for us to kind of get our arms around this. Talk about that.
Yeah, you bet. Pretty simple. Give yourself fully to the Lord. So when it comes down to all this, and we've studied the text, and we're going to need to put some wheels on this, this is how it's helped me through the years. Give yourself fully to the Lord. So there's our G. Obligate yourself to spiritual change. obligate yourself to spiritual change. So this is not just an issue of I want to know more. It is, you know what, I'm a sinner, and God has revealed through his word areas that I can constantly and continually improve in. So obligate yourself to spiritual change. Analyze your personal struggles. So there's the A, G-O-A, analyze your personal struggles. And your struggles are not my struggles, and my struggles are not your struggles. Every one of us, we're going to have different issues that we're battling on a daily basis. So it has to be personalized in that regard of who I am and my inclinations. And the last step is so important, G-O-A-L. So give yourself fully to the Lord. Obligate yourself to spiritual change. Analyze your personal struggles. And here's the last one. List practical steps to move forward. You know, that old adage through the years of if you aim at nothing, you'll be sure to hit it every time is so true in regard to how do we apply the Bible. I think we have to give very specific things and to write those out. I've got things that I'm constantly working on in my life, and about the time I think I have them mastered, I have to go back and do it all over again. So I want to list very specific issues that I need to work on or improve so that I know that's what I'm focusing on. That's what I'm praying through the power of the Spirit to help me grow in that particular area.
Dr. Mark Yarborough from Dallas Theological Seminary, offering a little acrostic goal. Give yourself fully to the Lord, obligate yourself to spiritual change, analyze your personal struggles, and list practical steps to move forward. One of those practical steps is to memorize Scripture. And we have mentioned last week, we started our Memory Verse Monday with a good word from Colossians 3 about our thought life. Today, our memory verse is from Ephesians 4:29. Do not let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouths, but only what is helpful for building others up according to their needs, that it may benefit those who listen. That's Ephesians 4:29. And with our Memory Verse Monday, we bring you some thoughts from Andy Stanley as we review these important words.
Speech, this is a big one for me. The lie sometimes that fuels our speech is, I can't help what I say. As soon as he starts in, I just find myself saying all this stuff. As soon as she walks in the door, I find myself saying all this stuff. When my kids come in and they're at each other, I just find myself saying all this kinds of stuff. As soon as he calls, you know, there I go. Here's the truth. Let no unwholesome word proceed out of your mouth, except such as a word as is good for edification, that is building up, according to the need of the moment, so that it will give grace to those who hear. Let me use your imagination for a minute. Imagine a family where no unwholesome word proceeded from anyone's mouth, except such a word as was good for edification, that is building people up, according to the need of the moment, that it might give grace to all who heard. Imagine a family like that. Imagine being a boss like that. Imagine being an employee like that. Imagine an organization like that. Imagine a church like that, where our speech was governed by, I'm going to let no unwholesome word proceed out of my mouth, except such a word as is good for edification, according to the need of the moment, that it might give grace to all who hear. See, so those of you who have a hard time controlling what you say, that verse needs to be right there. That the first thing that comes to mind is, no, I'm not going to let any unwholesome word proceed out of my mouth, except such a word as is good for edification, according to the need of the moment, that it might give grace to those who hear.
Ephesians 4:29 is our memory verse for this Monday, and I hope that you can reflect on it throughout the week. Don't let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouths, but only what is helpful for building others up according to their needs, that it may benefit those who listen. Or you find a translation that works for you and commit that to memory, and we'll have another one next Monday as well. Good way for us to just let the Word of God dwell in us richly. Talking about the Ten Commandments today, about studying God's Word. Hey, we want to put God's Word into action, and we have a great opportunity the month of August for the Live Free Faith and Fitness Challenge. Now, I don't know if you're into fitness, Ted, not looking at you.
Right.
I know both of us could work on that a little bit more, but maybe you know somebody who is going to have signed up for the challenge, and you can be a partner with them in helping them to fulfill their mileage goals to walk, run, or bike, and a fundraising goal as well. It all is to raise funds for rescuing lives and transforming community. It's through International Justice Mission. It's a partnership, and you can sign up today. We're going to get going on that in August, coming up soon. So go to myfaithradio.com and get signed up for the Live Free Challenge.
Easy to sign up, easy to fundraise through social media. Just tell people what you're doing. They'll get on board and help us achieve our goal of $50,000.
Tomorrow we're going to talk about one of the important issues of our day. It's the refuge, seeking refuge on the shores of the global refugee crisis. Matthew Sorens will be in studio tomorrow. I look forward to talking with you as well here on Connecting Faith.